introduce our main speaker, Tom Ive.
Tom Ivester, I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Southern Pines, North Carolina, and I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group. Sobriety Day is February 2nd of 57. And ain't as bad as it sounds. It sounds awful, but it's all right. You get used to it after a while. I'm delighted to be here. It's a good event here. By the way, I'd like you to know now, I'm not one of those expensive speakers that eats up the expenses. Some people in this group are crafty enough to know when you're coming to town. And so say, hey, by the way, why don't you spend an extra day or two and stay out here and do a foot washing or something at the specific group? I'm going to have to get to work a little quicker than I'd like to, because told me I could talk as long as I wanted to, but you guys were leaving at 8:30. And so, yeah, I like to quit about the time you do. I tell you, if you do much speaking, and probably most of you've seen this, we're a funny bunch. We're a courteous bunch, for the most part. And when you're talking to a group, you can tell when you're finished. Yeah, I mean, no bell has to ring, but it just seems like a film drops over folks' eyes, and they'll just sit there just kind of like in a coma and make no fuss. But when that happens, you're done. I mean, you're flat done. You keep talking if you want to, but you're talking to nobody but yourself. And so what I've tried to develop is a little skill to get about 2 minutes ahead of that. And so, when I see that film coming, man, look out. Don't even blink slow, because I'll think that's go time. And I'm going to quit in a heartbeat, because I like to quit when you do. And I am delighted to be here. And I'm glad to see all the action going on, all the birthdays, to be able to help celebrate 25 and 29 in 1 year. That's just really great. So it's good to be here. Really appreciate the action. Appreciate seeing a bunch of friends. I do want to welcome the minority here who happen to be from Las Vegas. Y'all better behave. We'll take over while we're here. But it really is a hoot. Now, I want to tell you about what I'm supposed to. That's what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. And I am going to have to do it in a hurry. It won't sound like it, because I'm from the Deep South. And for me to make a 45-minute talk would take about 2 hours. And so I'll have to cram it and go hard as I can. I'll probably speak faster than I can think. I'm a guy who I guess we all get started in our various ways. But I'm a guy who, many of you know, found myself at the age of 24 sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary. And certainly I knew where I was, I knew the address, I knew all of that. But when I came to my senses and realized who I was, where I was, what my life had become, who I really and truly was, it was not a great scene. It was not a good thing to look at. I'm a 24-year-old guy, and I am a flat loser. I'm an absolute loser. I'm a guy who looked back on a life that no matter which way I looked, it looked bad. When I looked at my history, I didn't know of a single person in the first 24 years of my life who would not literally have been better off if they had never seen me. Anybody that was unfortunate enough to get closely involved with me either regretted it or should have. They either got embarrassed, misused, abused, taken advantage of, hurt, disappointed, heartbroken, all of that. If anybody got close to me and stayed too long, they got dirty in the process. And it wasn't particularly behavior, it was just the effect of the alcoholism, because I was a guy who, when I drank, I could not predict my behavior. And when I drank, it was almost always destructive, at least to me and all too often to other people as well. And so I look back at a life that was a pretty ragged-looking mess. I'd started drinking seriously when I was 16. Mine was a fairly quick and episodic kind of drinking. That I guess we come in slow-growing types. You know, some people drink, I don't know how it takes them so long, but some people take forever to develop alcoholism. Man, I did it almost overnight. Not quite. But I started serious drinking at 16. 2 years later, I developed alcoholism when I was 18. Now, I was not keenly aware of that when it happened. We refer to what happened to me as crossing a line from whatever kind of drinking I'd been doing before, wild, crazy, celebrational drinking or whatever, into uncontrolled drinking or alcoholism. And the best I could tell in hindsight is that happened to me when I was about 18. And I don't remember it because I was probably extremely drunk the day I crossed that line and would not have noticed a minor thing like that. But years later, when I got sober and started to look back, I could recognize that while it wasn't clearly marked anywhere, there was a distinct there was a clear line. But God, I've gone brain dead here. Clear line between the kind of drinking I've been doing before and then what happened afterward. Now, to an observer, it wouldn't have looked any different. I don't think I drank anymore. I drank as much as I could before I was alcoholic. When you drink so much you can't lay on the floor, that's about as good as it gets. I mean, you're not going to beat that. And I did that long before I was alcoholic. I went to jail before I was alcoholic. Got lost car, you know, lost home, lost whole state sometime. So I was a guy that was a real wild, crazy drunk. And then once I crossed that line and developed alcoholism, my life was to never be the same and never will. That I developed this illness. Now, I probably know more than I can understand about it, but I like to keep stuff extremely simple so I can understand it. And what I understand, well, the best definition I've ever heard of what happened to me at age 18 is found in the third chapter of our book, and it's a simple little sentence that sounds mild, almost garden club type of comment. It says, "We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking." That's me. I'm a man who lost the ability to control my drinking. And what I've just said, for my money, is the sum total of my problem. Yeah, I'm somebody who, just like many of us do, I'm somebody who screwed up every way it's possible to screw up. I went to jail more times than I can remember or care to remember. I don't know how many times I've been to jail. It was quite a lot. I like to think I went exactly the right number of times. I don't have to explain that. You know, that was just a part of it. I was somebody. Yeah, there are many alcoholics. I won't ask anybody to embarrass themselves by sticking their hand up, but there are alcoholics in this room who have never been to jail. I mean, never. I can't figure out where you were. I mean, my God, how could you? We did a survey in Charlotte, North Carolina in 1960. Now, you know we had real alcoholics back then. I mean, hairy-legged drunks. Man, these were bad drunks. Worst case scenario. We did a nose count. One of the questions was, have you ever been in jail for as much as one night? 70% had never done it. I thought, what a bunch of wimps. What on earth is going on, man? But it's amazing. I'm constantly amazed how many alcoholics got the same job. I mean, some alcoholics don't get fired. I mean, they work forever. People don't even know they're working there sometimes, including them. But they just stay there, married to the same wife. That's bizarre. That is absolutely bizarre. But anyway, that what happened, I lost that ability to control my drinking. And I did all of the stuff of alcoholism. All of the stuff. Going to jail, nut houses, hospitals. Woke up one time married to a lady I didn't even know. I mean, didn't know her. We got acquainted very quickly. I woke up and said, "Who might you be?" And she said, "Mrs. Ivester." And I said, "Uh-oh." Bad news, man. That shouldn't even happen in Vegas, man. But it does. And she saw what she had. And her prize catch didn't look so good. And so, but anyway, I mean, just the crazy, crazy, bizarre stuff. Now, all of that for my money, this is about as heavy as I'll get tonight, all of that for my money has little, if anything, to do with alcoholism. We're men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. Alcoholism isn't measured by circus behavior. My God, that's part of being drunk. I mean, some people get drunk and get goofy. That's just all it is to it. It doesn't define how many car wrecks I've had, how many times I've been to jail. All of that stuff matters not. I know people who made a career going to jail who are not alcoholic. And bad drunks who've never been. So it doesn't really measure. You know, I'm somebody who if I take a drink, I cannot predict what I'll do. That is the sum total of my problem. Everything else is circumstantial to that fact. Circumstantial. So the core issue is that I'm a fellow who cannot control his drinking. So that was my life. I was one of those kind that was a quick kind of a guy. I was one of those fellows that just, I drank a lot. I didn't have any patterns of hopes and ambitions and all of this stuff. I might have had them, but they were vague at best. And so I was somebody that just, I had an ability to, you know, on a given day, if I was sober, I could make a good impression on people. I was somebody who almost always got overrated by people. I still do. I mean, people think I know stuff. I don't know stuff. I sit around and look worried, you know. I look like a guy in deep thought. I'm like that because I can't think of what to say. But I had a boss one time tell me I had a lot of potential and told me I was the best employee he ever had, 3 days a week. And so I was a world beater who never quite got out of starting block. My career lasted a sum total of 8 years, and I went from that guy who found the magic of alcohol at 16, developed alcoholism by 18, and by 24, I had reached a point where I'd gone through a military career where I was set out to become an officer and wound up being thrown out with an undesirable discharge, unfit for military service. 20 years old. And you know about how much impact that had, none. And when I got out, I just drifted around, obviously without a lot of thought, because I wound up in Detroit. You know, I feel a sort of a peculiar sense of pride right now. If any of you notice the newspaper much, we're number one again. Read the paper, you'll see what I'm talking about. When I improved, I went to Flint, Michigan, which is three steps down from Detroit. Flint, I'm proud to say that, thanks to my contribution, at one time was voted the worst city in the United States in which to live. And when that happened, I didn't brag about it, but I felt a little sense of pride. Yeah, well, at least I helped put them on the list, man. So, anyway, that's where I drifted and wound up there. And wound up unemployed, darn near unemployable. And I was a guy who drifted from trying to work at regular work and all that kind of stuff into day labor and into finally hustling and scuffling on the street. And this is during my late teens and early 20s. And I reached a point in life where I was so full of, you know, I said that the illness is about what happens on the inside, that I've lost the ability to control my drinking. You know, the hell of alcoholism is not in the wreckage that surrounds, it's in what happens on the inside. The alcoholism is about dying on the inside, losing the spirit, losing the will to live, losing the sense of decency and integrity and worth. And that's exactly what happened to me. Really interesting to me that I don't get too interested because y'all gonna quit. But it's interesting to me that, you know, we use the term denial a lot, except in the big book, that we don't use it at all. And I think we don't use it not because Bill didn't know the word, but because it doesn't have application. It's a lightweight term for what happens with guys like me. And what Bill used was two words. One was delusion, not denial, delusion. An inability to differentiate the true from the false is the way it's described in the book at one point. Or illusion, an inability to see my life as it is. And that really explains to me, because as I was accelerating down that destructive path, living a kind of life that would have looked bizarre to a wino. And while that's going on, I don't even see it. You know, when I would come to in the latest mess, whatever it happened to be, married to a stranger, in jail, psych ward, wrong town, all this stuff, every time I'd come to and take a look around at the latest wreckage of the past, I would experience the same thing that it was referred to in the book somewhere. It refers to that state of mind that I would always come to with pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. Total feeling of worthlessness, of uselessness, of irresponsibility, that I'm a burden on everybody that knows me. Always those kinds of thoughts. And what would follow would be my alternatives. What do I do? You know, number one would always be, why don't you just do yourself in? Everybody would be better off. Serious consideration. Or why don't you just keep going? Don't even make any pretense of going back and taking a place in life. Just drift away. Many people do. Many people do just that. I observe some fellows walking around the streets of this city today who are living in exactly that zone. Exactly. And I came perilously close to doing just that. I've just given up and totally given myself into this condition. And I'm talking about as a young man in his 20s. And or do you suck it up and go back and try again? And all the time that was going on, I never saw that in focus. Never once did I come to and say, look what you've done. God, you shouldn't have started drinking. I never had that thought that I can recall. I didn't think that taking a drink led to that kind of devastation with me. I didn't give a lot of thought to it. I thought the reason I was like that was because I was no good. I was reckless and irresponsible and undisciplined. That's exactly what I believed, which might have been true. What I didn't understand is that when I take a drink, I can't predict what I'm going to do. And that's what it'd be. But I never saw that. And I think that's why this notion of illusion, an inability to see that. You know, my life seemed normal. As bizarre as it was, it seemed normal to me. I'd see somebody with a lunch bucket. They look strange. With a lunch bucket going to work. Or taking kids to school or to church. Yeah, that looked strange to me. It was a different world. And so that's who I was. And so that's how I'm crashing and burning and bouncing around between Detroit and Flint and Saginaw and got through with day labor and then started just hustling and using people. I was not a criminal per se. I've never done a predatory crime in my life. I was like a social leech in a way. You know, I was somebody, I had some kind of an ability to, they call it conning, but I had the ability to get people's confidence. And I had a tendency to get people to feel sympathy toward me and want to help me out. And any time they had that feeling, I would let them experience the pleasure. And but now, I'm not proud of that. Yeah, I'm not proud of that whatsoever. But that's the way I live, using folks. You know, and the place I lived in, if you ever happen to want to go on an interesting vacation, go to Flint. Drive around and take a look. And you imagine trying to live in just sort of a normal existence in that environment. You know, when you live in that kind of a world, and I lived in the worst parts of Flint. When you live in that kind of world, you don't live a normal environment. In that environment, the food chain is basically made up of the rollee and the roller. Somebody go get rolled every night. And it just happens to be who's friskiest on a given night. Some night be me, some night be the other guy. Some night I drink, the other guy drink. That's just the way it worked. I don't to this day consider that criminal behavior. It was just the way the economy worked. I mean, whoever gets there first gets it. And so I'm not going back hunting to make amends. If I got to make amends to anybody in Flint, they're going to have to come to me. I am not going to them. But they didn't. It's just that bizarre stuff. And then I wound up one day, and many of you know, I got a lot of friends in this group. Many of you know, I was one of those alcoholics for whom this great disaster was in the cards. And yeah, unfortunately, it happens too many times. But thank God, most alcoholics never realize their worst fears. I've never met an alcoholic who hadn't had morbid fears about doing great damage to somebody else. Thank God, most don't. Most alcoholics, deep down, are decent folk, do some goofy stuff, but deep down, really don't want to hurt anybody. And I was no different. I always knew I was capable of anything, But I never believed I would ever do anything that is just that couldn't be undone. And I was one of the kind of guy I'd wake up in blackouts and nearly always in panic. You know, frantic to put together, where am I supposed to be? What have I done? What story have I told? That kind of thing. One morning I woke up in jail in Flint, and no novelty there. That was a familiar routine. And as I was awake for a little while, I went up to the bars and the jailer walked by. I knew him well. And I said, "Hey, guy, when could I get out?" He said, "I hope never." And walked on. I had no clue what he was talking about, but I knew he was serious. He was not playing. He was very serious. And said, "I hope never." I had no clue. No clue. And then some of the other guys in the tank told me that they'd read the papers or something. And they told me the night before some guy had been driving a car blind drunk down that street. And had struck and killed two people. And that I had been arrested for the crime. I had absolutely no recollection of anything about that whatsoever then or now. That is just one of those tragic things that happens in blackout sometime. And that the shock to me was I'm not an insensitive human. Even then I was not an insensitive human. And the notion of causing the death of two young people was more than this old boy could stand. And I knew I was capable. But I couldn't deal with the fact, and I just refused to believe that for a while, then gradually accepted the truth, that I'd done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. And only time I've ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. I didn't want out. I was afraid to get out. I was ashamed to get out. I was ashamed to be breathing, for God's sakes. So I just sat there, and my ambition was just disappear. And then some policeman, for reasons only he'll ever know, I never known who he was, nor tried to find out. I guess he elected to do what he did privately. But he saw the shape I was in. I mean, I was just a bubbling, destroyed human. And he saw the shape I was in. And, you know, somebody asked me if I did something. Yeah, sure, whatever. Yeah, I mean, I was done. I was a dead man walking. I was done. And he learned that I had family down in North Carolina and found out how to locate him, got in contact, said, "You got a guy up here in a lot of trouble. And if you want to do something for him, you better come on because he's getting himself into more every day." And they do what families often do. God knows it's amazing. I often think that families are punished more by alcoholism than we are. And so my family did one more time to get their little baby boy out of jail. It wasn't their first one, but thank God it was to be the last one. My mother died 29 years later with deep appreciation for a program that had given her a son for 29 years. You know, if I never, of everything I've ever done in AA, if I never got anything beyond that, I would be grossly overpaid. Just by that one statement. My sister's still living. I saw her this last week. And she's still got a chance that in case I want to get goofy, she may get a chance to get me out again. But nobody's had to for a long, long time. So they came up and got an attorney that I didn't want, and they started to negotiate, try to get me released on bond, which I didn't want. But I mean, how do you tell somebody you don't want out of jail? Yeah, I couldn't do it. I mean, I couldn't tell anybody much of anything. I certainly couldn't explain to anybody why I wanted to stay in jail. And, cause I didn't know why. Yeah, I couldn't have articulated anything. And they got an attorney and he got me released, on the 17th of July, I mentioned over detox this morning, the 17th of July, 56, I was released. Knew that I would never drink. Knew. How could you possibly drink after something like that? I mean, my God, that's an aberration to even think of such a thing. The more appropriate question, if you understand alcoholism, is how would you not drink? But I didn't know anything about that. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I never thought I would drink. The guilt was too great. I walked the streets all day on the 17th, all night. On the 18th, about noon, I started to drink, of course. And then from July 18 of 56 till November 19 of 56, I drank like no human I've ever seen. Now, I've worked with thousands of alcoholics. I'm not talking about a handful. I have worked with thousands of alcoholics. I've never worked with one like me. Yeah, I was a guy who just totally gave in. It was obvious I was trying to drink myself to death. You know, some people say that it may be 100% true, that they didn't commit suicide because of fear. I don't even think that was a consideration. The only thing that kept me from just overtly ending my own life was the thought of leaving a family with one more burden to bear. And I guess I figured if I was just found dead of an OD or whatever, that there would at least be a question. And I guess in my strange logic, that must be what I was thinking. And then the 19th of November, I was to be tried on the manslaughter charge. And I went down to court, finished a bottle of gin before I went. Just had 3 or 4 inches in it, finished that off. And by the grace of God and this program, that's been my last drink since, up to this day. And I didn't intend for it to be. I knew it was going to be the last one for a long time. Because when I went to court, I knew I wouldn't be coming back. I had no defense. You know, the hell of blackouts is, how do you defend a charge? I mean, how can I deny? Yeah, I'm not even conscious of where I was. You know, never mind argue that I didn't do it or whatever. There's no defense. My attorney, I'd never heard the plea. I was always in the drunk line. And my attorney had me to enter a plea of stand mute. And I thought, what an eloquent plea for somebody in a blackout. What else could you say? Stand mute. I was found guilty, of course, and that day sentenced to a maximum sentence of a minimum 5 and a maximum 15 years, Michigan State Penitentiary. And now that was no shocking thing to me because I knew it was coming. But there's something about it, you know, when that hammer comes down, I had, I guess, a very human instinctive reaction of fear. I mean, just a reflex, just an instinctive reaction of fear, but almost simultaneously the most real sense of relief I'd ever known. Because I knew it was over. It's over. Now, I don't mean there'll be a new day. I mean, it's done. It's done. The hammer's down. And the next day, I was led into that penitentiary with a chain with 5 other guys. And when I walked in, I remember the clear thought, well, oh boy, you won't hurt anybody else. That was my thought. If I had any kind of an objective, it would have been to just disappear. All I wanted to do was just be gone and not have to face people. And they see what to put me in there. I was always a guy that you wouldn't have known it by seeing me in action, but I was always instinctively a pretty isolated type of guy. I was not a gregarious, outgoing type of fellow. You know, but I was somebody, there was a lot of the what propelled my drinking was that's where my freedom came from. If you'd have seen me, you'd have thought I was a town clown or something. But, you know, that was not me. And so after all of this, I was as isolated as any human I've ever seen. They put me in a cell. I didn't know who was in the cell on either side of me. It wasn't that I didn't care or was unconcerned. They just didn't exist because I was living in my own, almost like a guy in a catatonic state. I mean, I'm just shut down in every department. Didn't converse with anybody unless he asked me a direct question. And then one day, the thing that started to turn this deal in a new direction. And I'll tell you this, you know, I'm a fellow with a lot of passion about service. You know, not only because of the fundamental nitty-gritty value of it, because, you know, I believe that every one of us got here as a result of service by somebody. Now, it would have come in 1,000 different forms, but it comes out as a result of service. And one of the reasons I have passion about having our active outreach stuff, so to speak, you know, so that we go to where drunks hit the wall and help them get up and find some recovery. One of the reasons I'm passionate about it is because of the way I found AA. And what happened, I'm the guy sitting in that cell doing anything you can do to keep from thinking. And one day, a guy called me out for an interview, did his normal social worker type of interview with me. I did my standard form of lying, I'm sure. I mean, I didn't have to plan to lie. I had to plan to not lie. I mean, lying was an instinctive behavior for me. I didn't have to make one up. They were automatic. And so I'm sure that he asked his questions. I probably lied like a dog if I answered at all. And when we got through, it probably didn't make much sense to me. It made a lot of sense to him. He made the same diagnosis everybody who ever captured me made. It always was something. You're an alcoholic. You're a drunk. You're a problem drinker. I'd heard that forever. And this guy was a little different. He said, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. And I said, yeah. I mean, my God, that's obvious. You know, I mean, I got a thick record. It's all about booze. I never committed a crime of any kind sober in my life. My whole record is about drunk and something. And so, sure, I mean, that was obvious. Didn't have to be a real genius to diagnose that. And so he said that you had a lot of trouble. Then he said something I'd never heard. Now, granted, this was a long time ago, and AA was not a well-known thing. He said, "We have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go." Now, that was just a friendly comment, you know. Like, it's raining, you ought to stay indoors, you know. I mean, there was no drama to the thing. It was just a flat deal. I didn't know what he's talking about. I had never heard of anything called AA in my life. I never heard of anybody helping drunks. I mean, back then, it just didn't. Like, we had a good time at detox. I felt jealous the way I'd never been in detox in my life, except to visit somebody else. Because when I came along, they didn't have such a thing. We had one, but they called it jail. And it works. Short term, but very effective. And so, anyway, anyway, that guy got through telling me about that. And I left, and then a little later, he sent me a note and said, "You can go to your first meeting, February 2nd of 57. I didn't realize then, but I learned later that penitentiary I was in was filled with over 6,000 men. And everything in there was crowded, including the AA group. And you had to have an open chair before you let the next person in. And so that's what happened. I saw in retrospect that chair came open and he said, "It's yours." And so here I went. I didn't want to go to AA. I didn't want to go anywhere. I mean, it could have been a girly show. I wouldn't have wanted to go to anything. I didn't care what it was. Isolated people, the last thing they want is go yuck it up with somebody. That's the last thing. I wanted to sit in that cell, stare at my navel, and do what I could do to keep from thinking. That's what I wanted to do. But I was I so blessed. I was totally defeated. I was beaten. I was absolutely beaten. I had no fight left. And when I got that little note from that guy, I wandered into my first AA meeting, had no clue what it would be. I thought it was going to be some kind of a religious hootenanny of some sort. And so I was braced for that because I'd been totally out of that stuff for a long, long time. But I just couldn't imagine helping drunks without a whole bunch of hooping and hollering of some sort. And so I figured that's what they're going to do. Walked in, the officer checked me in, sat down. First thing they did was pray. First thing. That serenity prayer. And while they were praying, I'm thinking to myself, see there? I knew it. Here we go. We're off and running, man. They'll be here with the drums and snakes and stuff and forth. I could see it coming. Then they read a bunch of stuff. My God, y'all read very little here tonight. I mean, they read everything. Everything. Good God. The Encyclopedia Britannica. They were just reading right on. Then they introduced the speaker, and I listened to the first alcoholic I ever heard tell his story. I'll never forget him. He made an absolutely unforgettable impression on me. I thought he had to be about the most stone idiot fella I'd ever seen in my life. I thought, why on earth would this fairly decent looking man get up in front of 300 hair-legged convicts and bare his soul like that? I mean, that made no sense to me. I didn't understand. I mean, I'd heard people tell, the alcoholics tell stories, but not their own. You know, I had a story for any occasion, but you bet it didn't have anything to do with me. Now, this guy had to be telling the truth. Nobody gonna make that up. And I sat there in amazement, kind of figuring out, what on earth is he doing? I had no clue that was shared experience in the hope of identification. Well, if it was identification, I didn't identify with one iota of anything he uttered. Nothing. As different from me as anybody I ever met. And the amazing thing, when he finally quit, I left. Probably more confusing was when I came in the next week, I was back. Nobody sent for me. Nobody would have missed me if I hadn't have gone back or cared. I mean, my God, these guys had their own trouble. They weren't worried about this yo-yo sitting in his chair last week. No, nobody would have cared, nor me. What happened was that guy, he was truly the most enthusiastic man I've ever met. He was a delegate for the state of Michigan the year that I thought he was the village idiot. But he was a fine man. He was just different than anything I'd ever seen. And so I started going back. I was really blessed, and I won't elaborate on it because I got to get you out of jail here before we quit. But I just say this, what got me out of jail, that group that I went into was called the Recovery Group at the State Prison of Southern Michigan in Jackson, Michigan. That'll always be my home group. I just don't want to be an active member of it. You know, I'll always be spiritually a member and a visitor when I get a chance. But it'll be home. And it'll always be home because that's where AA came together for me. I was really blessed in that, I don't know if it's in spite of or because of, but because of the austere conditions there, or in spite of them, we had as fine an AA group as I've ever seen. I belong to a good group right now. I belong to a strong, healthy, three-legacy group. I'm not a meeting guy. I'm not somebody who runs around, looks for interesting conversations. No, I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is about a group of alcoholics in action, in purposeful action. And that's exactly what that was. These guys were organized to try to carry the message to just what a group exists for. The only reason a group exists is to carry its message to the next alcoholic, to the alcoholic still suffering. That's the only purpose of this meeting. We do a lot of stuff here tonight, but bottom line, the only purpose we've got here tonight is to carry the message to the next alcoholic still suffers. And that's exactly what that group was about. And somehow or other, those guys picked up on me as either a guy with a lot of needs or a guy with worth investing in or something. But they picked up on me and started getting me involved in that group. And I became an AA member in that group. And I mean a member. I don't just attend meetings. I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. I belong to a home group. I need things that anchor me, steady me, solidify me in the program. And I learned that in that place. The guys back then, we didn't take people through the steps. We hadn't developed that arch yet. And we didn't do it. We just sort of coached each other and talked with each other. And what I've learned is that if you do the steps to the best of your ability, as honest as you know how, you can't screw them up. You can't screw them up. You might be able to do them better some way. But there is not an esoteric science or art. It's about being honest with some spiritual principles that will change my life. And so I was introduced to that kind of thing in that institution. And they worked for me. These steps worked for me when I was locked up like a wild animal in a maximum custody penitentiary. I became a free man in that environment, a free man, every way but physically. I'd been in prison my entire life. The prison of my alcoholism was more severe than any confinement I ever had. And I became a free man because this program worked for me. And I knew that I had a solution. I knew that I had a way of life that would last me the rest of my life. In that program, I learned something about leadership. I learned something about taking responsibility. I learned something about stepping forward. And I'll tell you something, for this old boy, that was never easy. You know, I'm not kidding you, I was an isolated type of guy. Now, somebody told me I was going to have to lead a meeting or read at a meeting, I'd go almost into a panic attack. Man, that was the scariest thing I ever thought of doing. The hardest thing that I ever had to learn how to do in Alcoholics Anonymous was walk up and meet somebody. That was not my style. That was not my instinct. My instinct was to stand back and observe. But I learned in this program that if I want to get through fear, I got to step through it. And that's what I started to do. And now the folks think I'm the Dale Carnegie of AA. Yeah, I'll welcome anybody. I don't mind welcoming people to their own group. It doesn't bother me. I don't want AA to be a lonely place, and it ain't going to be if I'm there. Because I'm going to do everything I can to make it a warm and welcoming place. My God, that sense of belonging is so important. So important. And that's what groups are about. And that's what happened there. I had a transforming experience. I got through my inventory. I got into amends. As you can well imagine, with the history I had culminated with taking two human lives, I had enormous work to do in amends. I won't itemize it now, but I'll be here till Sunday. If anybody wants to get in touch, you got some problem with some difficult amends that you think you can't make, feel free to contact me. Bob's got the busiest cell phone in the entire universe. But his number is well known. I think everybody in America calls him about twice a day. And so you can reach me through him. And so feel free if you've got some problem. I'd be glad to talk with you forever, but I won't take time right here. I'll just kind of wrap this way. I got a lot to say in just a very few minutes, so y'all listen quick. They agreed to let me out. I mean, I didn't even ask them, but they agreed that they would let me out if I'd go to North Carolina and not stay in Flint. And I said, well, let me consider that. You know I did. I said, show me the door. As I went back to North Carolina. I had to grow up some to appreciate my hometown. I thought the glitter and the glitz and the noise and this and the machine and this kind of stuff. I mean, this was my life. And I didn't want to go to Mayberry, for God's sake. And but I had to grow up some to appreciate it. And I got immediately active in AA day one. And I've been that way ever since. I got active in prison work 2 weeks after I was out. It was a little simpler. I heard what she was saying about the jail commitments. It was a little simpler back then. I'm 2 weeks out of maximum custody on parole, and they say, go to the prison. And I said, man, I can't go over there. They say, ah, come on. I went. 2 months after I was out, I was outside sponsor of that prison. 2 months after, just about the same time, my parole guy came to me with a crime like mine and said, wouldn't you be better off if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't. And I'll tell you something. If you give your life to this simple program and you take on God as a manager, you better fasten that seatbelt because you never know where you're going. Never know where you're going. And I was never supposed to operate a motor vehicle, and I never even asked about it. And my guy asked me if I'd be better off. I said, yeah. And he set it up, and I was restored driving privileges less than 3 months after I was paroled from maximum custody in another state. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And it's amazing to me. I'm absolutely never ceased to be amazed at what happens when God's got work He wants me to do. I took Him on as a manager, and it's amazing to me where that's taken me. I mean, I've gone through doors I wouldn't have even knocked on. And elected DCM 5 months after I was out. 2 years after I was out, I was contacted by the headquarters of the North Carolina prison system. And a man on the phone, I'd met him one time for briefly, and he introduced himself, and he said, we wondered if you would consider accepting a position, a professional position in our prison system. Now, you think about who I'm telling you about. I'm talking about a guy 2 years out of maximum custody, still on parole, and they're asking me to be a professional in a prison system. And when I heard that, I didn't faint, but I said, do you know who you're talking to? And the guy said, oh, yeah, we've checked you out. And of course they had. And to him, I said, what I honestly, I said, God knows, man, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine. To myself, you know what I said. Ain't no way. As of that day, there had never been an ex-con in the history of this planet hired into a professional position in a correction system. I knew they weren't going to start with me. But if they're going to start at all, they're going to have to start with somebody. So they started with me. And I was employed. And I'll just have to wrap up. I've only got about 48 more years of stuff to tell you. And so I'll tell it to you in 2 minutes. You know, that started out to a magnificent career. I wound up unbelievably. I wound up warden of penitentiaries rather than being in them. Wound up as a top administrator in my state, you know, working with every facility in the state. Unbelievable career. Put in 39 years. And since then, yeah, I've been incredibly active in Alcoholics. I've been incredibly active ever since I've been here. I'll just tell you this one little story. I had a wife when I came in here. I know you get quick marriages, and I wonder if somebody took my wife down and married her. Oh, there she is. I'm going to tell them this, and then you can stand up and you see that lovely person. Yeah, I've been, if there's an AA widow in this country, it's that gal sitting right there. Yeah, I've been as busy as anybody I know for as long as anybody I know. But I honestly believe, no, I don't believe, I know, that when I'm operating in principles, AA doesn't compete with my life, it richly nourishes everything in my life. This girl and I will be celebrating 40 years of continuous marriage in July, if she behaves. Stand up, girl. Right there. She's... And as she came with me, she doesn't travel with me a lot. It's amazing how her values shape. You know, when I'm going to Jockstrap, Mississippi, she has absolutely no interest in that. Yeah. But Las Vegas, oh, I might consider going with you and lose a few $100 or something. That she, that girl has to get some sin out of her system. And so anyway, that victim of AA abuse, a few of us back, she was sitting there looking at me one night, kind of dreamy-eyed. I thought she had some notions or something. And she said, "I'm going to buy you a car." And I said, "I don't need a car. I got cars." She said, "Yeah, but I want one that'll run for you." I said, "No, I got good stock out there." And she said, "But you deserve it." She said, "You spend your entire life traveling around trying to help folk, doing all kind of stuff." She said, "You deserve it." And I said, "Girlfriend, don't you even think about that word in connection with me. If I got what I deserved, I'd be hitchhiking." She said, "Well, I just want to buy you one." I said, "All right, go for it." And she did. I would have never picked that color. I never would. Yeah, it just looked kind of sissy to me. But it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Well, I guess the point of all of that, you know, is that, I guess, stay here forever and you'll get a car from somebody. I think the point makes itself that in this program, give yourself to it, give it all you got. And I'll guarantee you, you can't give away more than you get. So all the best.